Olivet Discourse, Part 5, the fifth talk in a series on the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24 and 25, was presented by Ron Julian on July 28, 1996, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
I fully expect for us to finish our discussion of the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24. We have one more parable to talk about. Perhaps you will recall that I've been saying essentially that Jesus' purpose in the Olivet Discourse was not so much to give us a timetable of how it's all going to happen and how we can tell when he's coming back and so on, as it is to prepare his disciples, and then ultimately us, for the reality that in spite of the fact that he, the king, the Messiah, was on the scene, nevertheless, the kingdom of God in its fullness, the reign of Christ over all the world, was in a visible, complete sense, having put down all enemies of God and so on, that was not about to happen. That in fact, the city of the great king was about to be destroyed, and it was going to be who knows how long before he ultimately returned and made things right. He follows up that teaching with a series of parables that emphasize in one way or another what the disciples and we ourselves we're going to face and are facing as a result of the fact that Jesus is gone and has left us to be faithful in following him. I mean, it would be one thing to be a follower of the Christ when he shows up, he's there, you say, I'll follow you, and then he puts down the enemies of God, enters onto his glorious throne, and the kingdom of God immediately begins. To follow him is to say essentially yes, and then the whole thing happens, and it's not that hard. It's not that big a deal in a sense. I mean, it is a big deal for them, even in that picture. But it's a much bigger deal to realize that he's going away, and what's going to be called upon me and upon all of us is to live in a world where he is not here, where evil has not been put down, and to continue to believe in him and to follow him and trust him. And that's, in one way or another, what these different parables have been getting at. We then come to the last of these parables, which I think continues this theme, and we're starting in verse 31. And I'm going to read it here. But when the Son of Man comes in his glory, and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne, and all the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate them from one another, as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will put the sheep on his right, and the goats on the left. Then the king will say to those on his right, Come, you who are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. Naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry, and feed you, or thirsty, and give you drink? And when did we see you a stranger, and invite you in, or naked, and clothe you? And when did we see you sick, or in prison, and come to you? And the king will answer and say to them, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even the least of them, you did it to me. Then he will also say to those on his left, depart from me, accursed ones, into the eternal fire which has been prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not invite me in. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick, and in prison, and you did not visit me. Then they themselves also will answer, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry, or thirsty, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not take care of you? Then he will answer them, saying, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. Well, I want to talk to you fundamentally about the message of this parable and what it is I think it's saying and what it says to us. Let me talk about, before I jump into talking about the message of the parable, let me talk about a couple of details along the way that I think are interesting, sort of tangential to the point of the parable. First of all, it's just worthwhile to ask ourselves the question, what do we mean in calling this a parable at all? It's not like the other parables in that most of the other parables take some natural day-to-day life situation and use it as an analogy to compare it to something about the kingdom of God. We've already seen a slave who's put in charge of the rest of the slaves, or five foolish maidens who don't take enough oil so that they're prepared for the bridegroom to be a long time, or several servants who are left with the charge of working and investing with the money that the master leaves them. These are real life situations that the people would have understood, and Jesus, in telling those stories, is saying, this thing that you do understand is like this other thing that you don't understand about the kingdom of God. This is a little different. And whether we want to call it ultimately a parable or not, I guess it depends on how we want to use the words and how we want to define them. But Jesus is doing something really different here. I think, though, that we should be a little bit prepared. It is a story. And although Jesus is saying, this is what I'm going to say when I come back, I don't necessarily think that Jesus is saying that this is a literal blow-by-blow verbatim account of what's going to happen on the judgment day. I think he's casting it still in the form of a particular kind of story because he has a particular point that he wants to make. There are going to be other things to talk about besides what this parable recounts. It's clear from the Bible that there will be. But here, he sort of put it together in a striking image of, okay, I'll tell you, this is what's going to happen. And he's doing it to make a very important point, I think. We note the language, come you who are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. This is not new information to us, but I just think it's striking and important to notice that that Jesus here is referring to those who are blessed, those who have been blessed by the Father. Instead of being under his curse, they are under his blessing. And what is it that constitutes that blessing? Why are they blessed? It's because from the beginning of the world, God has had in mind a kingdom. And he has been preparing that kingdom for his people. That's what the story of the Bible is about, ultimately, is God stepping into a world which is corrupted with sin and remaking it, restoring it, and establishing a kingdom for his people. That's our hope. That's what this is all about. So it's interesting that even in this story, the response of the king here is to welcome the blessed ones and congratulate them because they are about to enter into this kingdom. And It's something that I've said on many occasions, but I just want to emphasize again that I think if we haven't understood that fundamentally what God is offering us and is doing for us is preparing this kingdom and preparing us to be citizens of that kingdom, then we haven't really understood what the Bible is talking about. That's the offer that God is making. That's the blessing that He is holding out. One other thing I think is interesting to comment on, he refers to the people that are welcomed, the sheep in this story, as the righteous. Then the righteous will answer him saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry, and so on. And that's a very important word in the Bible, I think. The word righteous is often translated justified. And this is something I've talked about with you a number of times before, I think, as well. But I just wanted to kind of rehearse it while we're looking at this here. Sometimes the word righteous is used to describe the character of someone in terms of whether or not they are a sinner or not, whether they are pure and good and worthy of blessing, worthy of approval by God, or whether they're not. So in that sense, the word righteous emphasizes the moral worth of someone. In that sense, then, we have Paul saying things in Romans like, there is none righteous, no, not one. So that nobody can go before God on the basis of their righteousness in this sense and say, you know, bless me, I'm righteous. There is another sense, however, in which the word is used, and that's when we typically translate it as justified instead of righteous. The idea here being that we are in the right with God, not on the basis of our moral worth, but on the basis of what Jesus did on the cross. That He has paid the penalty for our sins in order that we might be reconciled to God and be right with Him. And so there are places then, I think, where the word righteous refers to this justification that God is offering us. Again, in Romans, Paul talks about the righteousness of God, which in the context, when you go and look at it, I think is clearly talking about this justification which God has to offer us. God is making us to be in the right with Him. But I think there's a third sense in which the word righteous is used. And this is when the kind of rightness that is in view is not my moral worth. It's not talking about whether I'm a sinner or not, but it's talking about whether I am a person of faith or not, whether I am a person who knows God or not. The righteous are those who trust God, who confess their sins, who are following God and trying to understand who He is and what He wants and so on. And the Bible sometimes uses the word righteous, and unembarrassedly so, will use the word righteous to describe people who are clearly not free from sin. And one of the most striking examples is when Peter talks about righteous Lot, whose righteous soul was tormented in Sodom and Gomorrah when he was living there. Well, if you know the story of Lot, this is not a perfect human being that we're talking about in it by any means. But what characterized him was that he was a person of God. If you looked at Lot and you looked at the residents of Sodom, you saw something different. These were people who did not care what God had to say about what was right or good, and Lot was someone who did care about what God had to say about what was right and good. So there's this third sense in which the word righteous can be used. It doesn't, if we refer to ourselves then as those who are righteous, we are not denying our sinfulness. In fact, I would emphasize that we could go and look at places that demonstrate that one of the characteristics of the righteous is, in this sense, is that they are honest about their own moral weakness and failure. But it is righteous to do that. It is righteous to admit that you're a sinner. It is the right thing. God blesses those who are righteous in this sense, not because they've earned His salvation, but because that's the mark that they are His people, that they have seen their own need, that they have turned to Him, and so on. So I think it's quite likely in this case that Jesus, when he refers to these as the righteous, it is not because they are free from sin. His death on the cross was needed to pay the penalty of their sin. But they are righteous in the sense that there is this right thing about them. They are people who have a certain quality of faith, of trust, of longing for the things of God. At least that is what would make sense to me here. But now we come to the question. What's happening in this story? What is it that the king is pleased with this one group and not pleased with the other group? There are several schools of thought about this parable. Among those who would argue that, we have this fairly popular picture of how things are going to happen when Jesus returns. And perhaps you're familiar with this scenario, the idea that Jesus is going to return secretly, he's going to rapture away believers, and following that will be a 7-year period, some say, a 3.5-year period, others would say, that is often referred to as the tribulation, the great tribulation. And during that period of time, it is argued from the book of Revelation, a great host of Jewish believers is going to rise up. This is going to be the time when the Jews finally accept Jesus as the Messiah, and they suffer greatly during this period of the tribulation at the hands of unbelievers. So, one way of interpreting this parable is to say the brethren that are being referred to here are the Jews during the tribulation period. And this is a judgment that is coming upon the world based on how they treated the Jews during that time. If you look into it some, part of the reason that there are two reasons, I guess, that I don't think that is in fact what this parable was talking about. One of them is I'm not convinced by that whole scenario yet of Jesus coming back secretly, 7-year tribulation, and then coming back again. I think, and it seems fairly clear in Matthew that it's the case, that we're just looking at Jesus returning and gathering up his people and judging the world, a simpler kind of picture. So I don't think that separate group during the tribulation even exists at this point. So that's one reason why I wouldn't go this way. But another reason is that there is a real theological pressure on many people to try to come to passages that seem to suggest that our salvation is going to somehow depend on what we did. And the pressure is to want to somehow explain that away. To somehow say, well, no, see, believing in Jesus is how you get saved. So it isn't possible that he would come back and judge us based on what we do. That just is the whole point of the gospel, is that we're being freed from having to pay the penalty for what we do. So, in fact, it's not at all, I don't think it's a coincidence that the dispensationalist theological model that teaches the secret rapture and the 7-year tribulation and all of that is also very insistent on wanting to separate out any parts of the Bible that seem to suggest that our actions play some role in our salvation. And they want to separate that out and put it in a category of law. That's a different dynamic. That's not what we as the church get. It's something else. So I'm not sure that I could explain it totally. I'm not sure that I understand it totally. But the idea here is that, see, in this passage, this couldn't be saying that we are going to be judged based on how we treat other people, because that's not true. That's, the church doesn't get that deal. But after the church has gone away, now we're back under a legalistic sort of system where people are going to be judged based on what they do. So the part of the reason that I don't buy this as a way of explaining the parable is that I don't think we have to find that way out. I think if we were to go and look at the way the New Testament talks about salvation, it is clear that being a person of faith and living a certain way is connected. And so in places where it implies that we somehow are going to be saved based on what we do, I would argue that that's just another way of talking about being saved by faith. That is, people of faith are going to be living lives that tend in a certain direction. And so to say God is going to accept people of faith, or to say God is going to accept those whose lives have the mark that they are people of faith, really comes down to the same thing. So in this case, I would argue that we don't have to explain it away. I think this picture of Jesus coming and judging the sheep and the goats, you enter into the kingdom, you get tossed out, based on their behavior, the way he's describing it, I think that's exactly what this is a picture of. As scary as that might sound, I think that is what this is a picture of. That being the case then, I mean, that's what I'm saying, that's the case, I think. What is it, in fact, that's going on here? What is it that, what is the action involved that God is either accepting or rejecting? And I guess the question basically comes down to how should we understand this picture of feeding and clothing and visiting in jail the brethren of Jesus? What does he mean by that? There's one thing I think we can say right off, and I would argue that this is at the very heart of this story. This is at the heart of this parable, what it's really all about. Notice that the people, when the king embraces them and says, you know, enter into this kingdom which has been prepared for you, and he explains why they're getting in, they react in surprise. What do you mean? Now, some have argued that this indicates, the surprise here indicates that the people of God are so selfless and unfocused on themselves that they don't even notice that they're doing good things along the way. And no, I don't think so. I don't think that's what he's getting at. The surprise is not, what did we ever do that was right? The surprise is, when did we do it to you? He's saying to them, you fed me, you clothed me, you visited me in jail. And their surprise is, what do you mean? And this is the key, because what have we been talking about all along? This long period of time when Jesus is gone. So essentially what they're saying to him is, what do you mean we fed you and clothed you and everything? You've been gone. You haven't been here. How could we have done all of this stuff for you when you weren't here to do it for in the first place? I would have been glad to do it for you if you were here. If I had seen you at any time, anything you wanted, I would have done for you. But you weren't here. So what do you mean that I did it for you? That's at the heart of this story. The logic that says, you did it for me. That's what this story is all about. If we can understand why we did it for him, and why he would say that, even though he wasn't here, then we have understood the point of this story, I think. And it seems to me that there are two options. And you know, I'm really not as contentious and hard to get along with as you might think. I am perfectly willing to agree with people. I mean, it's not that I go out of my way to disagree with what everybody else is saying, but it just so happens that this is another one of those places where most of the teaching I've heard on this parable takes the other option from the one I'm going to take. And I hope that I'm just not being proud or, you know, I like to be set aside from the crowd or anything. I just don't think they got it right. This is the popular way of answering that question. How is it that we did it for Jesus? The brethren, my brethren that Jesus is talking about here, by brethren he means all human beings everywhere, even the poorest and the lowliest. And God has a great concern for the poor. And so Jesus is identifying himself with the poor and the destitute and saying that those are my brethren. And so if you are out there doing good for the poor, if you're feeding them and clothing them and sheltering them and so on, then what you've done for those poor, you've done for me, because the poor are my brothers, essentially, would be the argument. This is a very popular way of understanding this parable. This parable is often used to spur us to action on behalf of the poor and the homeless and so on. Well, I am not saying that being concerned for the poor is wrong. I think it's a very important thing. We are called to love. And we are called to love to such an extent that we are called to love our enemies. So to say that it is incumbent on us to be compassionate and merciful and gracious to all people in this world, I think is a truth. We are. And so the idea that we ought to be concerned about people who are having misfortune in one way or the other, I mean, that's right. That's good. The only thing that I get a little nervous about is that there are many people who, having taken this understanding of the parable, would basically go on to say then that this is the mark of discipleship. I mean, see, that's the crux. What is it? How can you tell the believer? And they would say, this shows that it is the person who is out there on the front lines, the person in the soup kitchen, the person, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Those are the people who are Jesus' people. Those are the ones that he's going to accept and embrace at the end. And so we sort of end up with this problem in that there are many people who very rightly are concerned for the welfare of the poor, who are in fact proud unbelievers, hostile to the Bible and to the things that God talks about. To say that helping the poor is sort of the mark of discipleship leaves us with a little bit of a problem there. And maybe it leaves us with a personal problem as well that we need to sort out for ourselves, which is, where does that leave me? I think that Jesus is saying something else here. And something that is more understandable, I think, and defensible from the Bible and makes sense of this story. Why he would say, you did it for me. He refers here to, in 40, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even the least of them, you did it to me. I think when he talks about these brothers of mine, he means his people. He means other believers. Now, there are many times when Jesus refers to our brothers in his teaching, and it is not entirely clear when he talks about our brothers whether he means anybody or our brothers in the sense of the community of faith around us. You know, if your brother sins against you and comes and asks for forgiveness seven times, why did he use the word brother? What's behind that? That's a little hard to say in various places. But there are a couple of places where he refers to his brethren. And in all the places that I'm aware of, when Jesus talks about his brethren, he's talking about believers. Maybe one obvious example is there's a place in the Gospels where his family comes to, and they want to talk to him. And he says, Who are my mother and my brothers and my sisters? Is those who do the will of God. Those are my mother and brother and sister and so on. So that he sees himself identified. My brethren are those who are my people. Those who, like me, see God as someone to be followed and obeyed and so on. And there are other places. When after the resurrection, he says, tell my brethren to meet me in Galilee. And the idea is, again, not every human being on the face of the earth, but his followers, his disciples, those who were with him, those who he saw as a part of his family. So I would argue that my brethren here has that same sense. That when he talks about these brothers of mine, that what he means is those people who identify themselves with him, those who belong to him, who are his people. Does it make sense that he would say, when you did it for them, you did it for me? Yes, it makes a great deal of sense, because Jesus teaches that very thing in other places. For instance, in Matthew chapter 10, earlier in the same book, verse 40 of Matthew 10, "He who receives you, my disciples," he's saying, "receives me. And he who receives me, him who sent me. He who receives a prophet in the name of a prophet shall receive a prophet's reward. And he who receives a righteous man in the name of a righteous man shall receive a righteous man's reward. And whoever in the name of a disciple gives to one of these little ones even a cup of cold water to drink, truly I say to you, he shall not lose his reward." Well, here's a very similar picture of receiving someone, helping them, giving them a cup of water. But the issue here is, in whose name are you receiving them? And the issue is not your name, but their name. Who are they? Who do you see them representing? If a prophet comes to you and says, "I'm a prophet," and you receive him as a prophet, then he says you'll receive a prophet's reward. If a righteous man comes to you and you receive him because he's a righteous man, then you'll receive a righteous man's reward. And if one of these little ones comes to you in the name of a disciple, as my disciple, saying, "I'm with Jesus, I'm following him," and you give him a cup of cold water, you shall not lose your reward. All of that dictated by that very first statement, "He who receives you receives me." You see the idea that there is something about the people of God, their priorities, their commitments, the fact that someone would be following Jesus, would be admitting that they are sinners, that would be seeking after what is right. For me to see a person like that and to respond to them in that name, not just out of general kindness, but because of the name that they're bearing, because they're saying, "Jesus is important to me, I'm following him." In accepting them, I'm essentially accepting Jesus. If they come in his name and I say, "I welcome you in that name," then the name of Jesus means something to me. And so in receiving you, I'm receiving him. That's the logic that Jesus is using here. That in this world, if we looked at Matthew 10, which we did, I don't know, a year or so ago, I forget. Most of that chapter is about how the people of this world are going to hate and reject the followers of Jesus. In one way or another, they're going to look at their values and reject them. They're going to look at their commitments and reject them. They're going to see them as foolish. They're going to try to entice them away from this foolish commitment to do something more worldly and more acceptable in the world's eyes. The disciples of Jesus are going to pay a price in this life, because this world and its treasures are not easily available to people who follow Jesus, because this world essentially does not approve of Jesus or his followers. So most of the chapter of 10 of Matthew is about how a disciple of Jesus is going to be rejected because he's a disciple of Jesus. Earlier in the passage, Jesus uses the language in 24, "A disciple is not above his teacher, nor a slave above his master. It is enough for the disciple that he become as his teacher and the slave as his master. If they have called the head of the house Beelzebul, how much more the members of his household?" The whole idea, you know, if they hate me, they're going to hate you. Well, the end of this chapter is looking at the flip side of that. If they don't hate you, if they receive you and welcome you and help you in my name, then rather than ultimately coming under the judgment of God, they're going to come under his blessing. So in Matthew chapter 10, Jesus is using the way people respond to his disciples as kind of this litmus test. Those who are of this world will reject ultimately the people of God, but There are others who will not reject them, who will welcome them, and who will accept them. And essentially, we're talking about other believers who are showing that they believe, that they welcome the ideas that Jesus taught, that they are following Jesus, that they are looking for the reward that Jesus offered. They're showing that by the fact that they respond to other people who believe those same promises and who are looking for those same rewards. That, as we've talked about a number of times, there are natural sorts of ties that you and I will make in this life based on family connections or interests, common interests, mutual things that are of mutual benefit. We'll enter into business relations with people so that each person might benefit financially or whatever. But ultimately, the people of God are going to see that the people in this world that they have the most connection to, the most in common with, the people that are theirs, the people that they should welcome and help, are the other people who share that same hope and have that same commitment. So the fact that we believe in Jesus and are looking to Him for what He has promised is going to be worked out in this life by our response to others who are looking for that same promise. I think that's what Jesus is getting at in Matthew 10. He says a similar sort of thing in Matthew 18. And I have just totally lost where it is. Oh, yes. At the beginning of Matthew 18, truly I say to you, unless you are converted to become like children, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever then humbles himself as this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever receives one such child in my name receives me. But whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble, it is better for him that a heavy millstone be hung around his neck and that he be drowned in the depth of the sea. So here again is this issue. Are you receiving this one in my name? Because if you are, you're receiving me. So that's what I think makes much the best sense in the parable of the sheep and the goats that we're looking at here. When he says, to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even the least of them, you did it to me. What he means specifically is these brothers of his share his name, share his commitments. They're following him. They believe in him. They're looking for what he has promised. And by helping them, by welcoming them and responding to them, if they're in jail, why would they be in jail? Because unfortunately, jail is not an uncommon place for people who believe in Jesus to end up. When we look in the book of Acts, a number of his disciples ended up in jail at one time or another. So, as much as I respect a ministry like what Chuck Colson is doing with Prison Fellowship, I think it's a great thing that he's doing, and I don't look down at it in the slightest. There is one little thing that I don't think is entirely biblical, and that would be to point to this, you visited me in prison, and say, see, by going to the prisoners, I'm going and seeking out Jesus. I don't think that's the logic of this. The logic of this is his brethren, those who share his name, to see them in their trouble and to reach out to them and help them. What I'm doing in being concerned about their problems marks me as a person who is ultimately concerned about Jesus. And that's why the king in this story comes along and says, when you did it to the least of these, you did it to me. Because you knew who you were dealing with. That is, you saw a person who was one of my brethren, who was a believer, who named my name, and you responded to them because of that. Well, I'm telling you, when you respond to my name being declared by someone else, it's as if you're responding to me. And likewise, those who were indifferent to his brethren showed their essential indifference to him. The point then, I think, is a very important one, is that, and we've seen this over and over again, that our discipleship, our following Jesus works itself out in various ways in this life. It is in the midst of life and the struggles of life and the difficulties of life, it is there that I work out my salvation. It is there that I sort out what do I believe and what am I about. It is there that I either learn about God and follow Him or am indifferent to Him and blow Him off. It is there in the midst of life that this happens. And one of the key places where that happens is you and I interacting with each other. I mean, we've seen this over and over again. But the fact is, here's Jesus saying it again, I think, that ultimately, if I can't see any significance, if I can't see a connection, if I can't see the importance of you to me because of the inheritance that we share, because of the Lord that we are following together, then that promise, that inheritance really hasn't hit home to me. It doesn't mean a whole lot to me. Jesus doesn't mean a whole lot to me if I can look at His followers and be so indifferent to them. And that's really the point that he's trying to get across here. In this time when he is gone, there is a sense in which I am still dealing with him, because I am dealing with other people who are following him, who are learning from him, who are seeking after that which he has promised. And thus, how I respond to him, in essence, is working itself out in this life in how I respond to you and how you respond to me. Okay, well, that's what I think is happening with that parable. We have some time, actually, amazingly enough, for questions or comments. Go ahead.
I think I understand you, but I want to frame this in sort of a couple of different ways and see if the way that I frame it, if you agree the way that I think you understand it.
Okay.
Okay, in the one case, it could be when he's talking to all the people that are righteous and unrighteous, the litmus test as to whether they're taking their inheritance or not could be whether or not they are loving, kind, and good and compassionate in general.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes.
And if that were the case, then it seems to me that you ought to be loving, kind, compassionate, and good in general to everybody.
Right. Right.
It's just the brethren doesn't quite. I mean, it could make sense, but it's harder.
No, right. If the issue is whether you're being judged on whether you're kind, good, and compassionate, to limit it to the brethren, you're right. It doesn't make sense.
The other case would be that it's a question of whether or not it's you're accepting or you're doing this for somebody because they're a Christian. Because, I mean, the opposite would be, yes, you're in need. I'm a kind, loving, compassionate person, but you're a Christian and I don't like Christians, and therefore I'm going to be, you know, mm-hmm. kind of crummy to you or sort of in some sense persecuting or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And whereas the Christian would say, you're in need, kindness and goodness and lovingness are assumed, but you're helping them because they're a Christian, rather than persecuting them because they're a Christian or something mm-hmm. like that. And that would be sort of the framework that you're
right.
reading this in.
Right. The issue is the thing centers around whether the fact that they're the brethren of Jesus, mm-hmm. what that means to you. Is that something that you ultimately dislike or is something that you ultimately like? And it's because of that that he's saying that if you do it to them, you're doing it to me. Because mm-hmm. if you don't like my brethren, you don't like me. And if you do like my brethren, and we have to understand like in the right sense here, because we're not all of us entirely likable all the time. But if I respond to his brethren, then I'm responding to him. And that's what I'm saying is the logic of it. It's not denying the importance of a general kindness and lovingness and that sort of thing. Right, but that's not the issue here. Just like there are other issues that this passage isn't talking about as well. I mean, there are lots of different issues that we face with God that are not coming up in this parable. What I'm saying is the one issue that this is pointing to, though, is while Jesus is gone, I'm still dealing with him. I'm still reacting to him and either working for him or against him, in that I'm seeing his values and himself ultimately as reflected in his people. That's, I think, what it's saying. Dan?
There's still a middle ground that I think needs to be acknowledged. Or if I meet Tucker one morning on the street corner and we're near the Glenwood restaurant and Tucker says he's hungry and I give him $5 and go on my way, I've done something gracious for a brother. But it wasn't in a very good spirit. I didn't even visit with him and I left. But you see, I just scored up some strokes because he's part of the brethren. He's part of the clique.
Right, right.
I don't like the feeling of just doing it because we're some type of special group. Yet, if I had the opportunity to be really gracious and didn't know another person was a Christian, but I did it in a Christian spirit, if I could be for that moment as righteous or as meek or as sincere as I possibly could be, not knowing he's a Christian or a non-Christian, take it out of the groupie feeling, I got the feeling that there's some middle ground. You used a beautiful example of Chuck Colson. I, as you know, he's a very good Christian man. And yet, he probably in Christian spirit helps a lot of non-Christians. So, does that not count? Is that not a righteous act? Is that not a meaningful thing to do? No, wrong. It is meaningful. And my action toward Tucker, just giving him $5 and being done with him for the moment, maybe I was too busy. Maybe it was a good reason. But you see, I want to put some middle ground in there with a meaningful action. But, can I leave you with that?
Well, yeah. But see, you and I are talking about two different things. Because in both of those cases, yeah, on the one hand, to sort of think that I'm chalking up brownie points because I did something for a Christian, there's nothing particularly noteworthy about that. And on the other hand, to be compassionate to someone because they need something from me out of a genuine concern and not concerning myself with whether they're a Christian or not, that's something very right. But what I'm saying is that neither of those situations is being addressed by this parable. What I'm saying is those would come under other commands and exhortations that we have. The issue is not, oh, I see Tucker on the street. I mean, you know, since we're talking about Tucker, I see Tucker on the street and give him a five and move on. But there are genuinely those places in life where the pressure is on me, either the fact that this person is my fellow believer is going to get over the hurdle of what otherwise might push me away or not. I mean, Paul talks about, you know, when he gets in trouble and he's in jail and he's going before the courts and all of this stuff, everybody disappears. You know, everybody's left me. Well, there's something about seeing the Apostle Paul in trouble and abandoning him because I don't want to get in trouble myself that says an awful lot about what his status as not only a fellow believer but an apostle of Jesus Christ. I mean, he's carrying the name of Jesus. And I think that Jesus is going to come along very naturally and say to the person who abandoned Paul in his hour of need, when you abandoned him, you abandoned me. That's what I'm saying is the logic of this here. We're not being exhorted to kind of put on a front and go around, you know. I mean, there are a lot of things that I can do, so-called in the name of the brethren, that, you know, just more Pharisaical posturing. That's not what Jesus is calling for. But the fact is that the course of my life is either going to show my essential indifference to people who are following Jesus or my essential solidarity with them, that I see them as important because they belong to Jesus and Jesus is important. So in that sense then, Jesus is saying that the reality of my discipleship is, it's not tested by necessarily by that $5 on the corner, although it could be. I mean, that could be genuine as well. But the idea is that he's warning me that in this life, I still have to deal with him because I'm dealing with him in the lives of his people. And in that sense, then, I think I think it speaks to a very real struggle that we have. I think if we look at ourselves as a group, I think we could see that all of us as human beings have a tendency to sort of gravitate to our own little circle. Now, Christians can gravitate to their own little circles too, and I don't want to deny that, but you know what I mean, that sort of sense that, you know, there's my family, there's the groovy people that I like to hang around with, and the rest of you are just kind of, you know, you're kind of a problem. And you know, I see you on Sunday, but you know, I don't know you, and you know, I get to know you, I might start finding out you got problems and you might want stuff, and who knows what I might get into. But the fact is that if I let that rule, if that's my primary motivation is keeping myself out of trouble, then I'm blind to the fact that these are the people of Jesus out here who may need me. And that's where the rubber meets the road, that I have to face into the question, these are the people of Jesus. Does that mean anything to me or not? Who? Roger? Did you have your hand up? No. Okay, Chris.
Maybe a comment relating to Sam's question. It might be possible to separate out the issue of being kind and generous, et cetera, from this issue of having solidarity with Christians. Like, for instance, you could be in a situation where, say, a Christian organization, like, I don't know, just for one that's happening right now, is the Promise Keepers are coming to town. And at the University of Oregon, at least, and probably other places, they're being badmouthed in a fairly serious way. And you could be in a situation where people are badmouthing this organization because they don't like what they stand for. And as a Christian, it might be appropriate in certain circumstances to speak up for what the Promise Keepers has to offer, or that they're a Christian organization, because you have solidarity with them as Christians. Whereas a person who is a non-Christian wouldn't want to do that. They wouldn't stand up for that organization. So it's not an issue of whether they're being kind and generous. It's an issue of whether you have solidarity with Christians. In the same way, if some organization was coming through town that a Christian didn't agree with, and they were being badmouthed, then we wouldn't necessarily step in and say, "Don't badmouth them," because right. we don't have solidarity with this other group. But that sort of takes away from the kindness, whereas in this passage, it's intimately connected with kindness and stuff.
Right. But yeah, right. That's it. Well, you know, if I could stop and make a personal comment here. I'm going to make a personal comment to give you all the opportunity to practice what we were just talking about here. My family's gone here, has been gone for several days, and was going to be gone for the next 2 weeks. And God, you know, I picture my life as being kind of like this work in progress, and God, you know, like a statue that God is kind of chiseling away at. Well, I discovered when they left that this was the time that God was going to take his chisel and cut really deep. It's been first 2 days especially that they were gone have been, I think without a doubt, probably the worst days of my life. I think I just about had a nervous breakdown, although I don't think I did. But it was really hard. And I'm facing the next 2 weeks sort of getting up every day, kind of having to face into this, and I'm trying to work on my book while I'm doing it. That's part of the reason that I stayed home. And it's the funny thing, it has been a terrible, terrible time, but I'm actually getting quite a bit of writing done in the middle of it, which I don't know what to think about that. But so I guess what I'm saying is, on the one hand, I don't need like round-the-clock intervention or anything like that. I am trying to write this book, and I do need to do that. And I really think this is a time when God wants for me to learn some things about my fears and to learn a little bit more about trusting Him and being content in the midst of what for me is a difficult situation. But at the same time, I guess I'm just inviting you to give me a call in the next couple of weeks or something, see if I fell off the face of the earth or anything like that, because I think I'm doing all right. Today, where are we here? They left Thursday and Friday. That was really bad. Saturday and Sunday have been better. And I think I'm learning to deal with it. And ultimately, I think, I really do believe that ultimately God knows what He's doing and that He's not just jerking me around. That's part of what I had to decide in facing into this. But I'm just saying, on the one hand, I really do need to do this. But on the other hand, being there at home alone, hour after hour, especially when it's been so hot. I mean, these days, my house is like an oven. And I wanted to go someplace cool. But, I mean, frankly, I spent most of Thursday and Friday crying. So there really wasn't any place to go. You know, where am I going to go? I'm going to go to Valley River Center and, you know, walk around. So it was really, really bad. So I guess I'm just inviting you. I mean, I'm saying, I'm not in trouble in one sense. God has His hand on me, and I think things are going the way they need to go. But I would welcome it if people wanted to call up or stop by or something like that along the way. It's always reassuring to realize that the people that are teaching you are on the edge of a nervous breakdown. I know, but oh well.